From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what Americans didn't know about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Newly declassified documents show that 30 years ago this month, we came closer to nuclear war than even the decision makers realized. And as former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara puts it, the missile crisis was replete with examples of misinformation, misjudgment, and miscalculation. We'll talk with Thomas Blanton, Executive Director of the National Security Archive. The archive filed the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that got the secret documents released. And so much for the crisis in Cuba. How about the crisis on Gilligan's Island? TV critic David Bianculli previews the pilot, which is about to be shown on TV for the very first time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The State Department acknowledged today that it was a mistake to give rush treatment to media requests for information from Bill Clinton's passport and citizenship files. Spokesman Richard Boucher said the decision to expedite the search for Clinton's files was made by low-level people.
There was, in fact, a memo that said these cases merit what's called formally expeditious handling under the law, which is only supposed to apply to certain very specific circumstances that are basically if somebody's going to be die or get injured, or if somebody's constitutional rights are going to be violated by any delay. Those circumstances clearly did not apply in these cases. That particular designation and other notations were clearly a mistake.
Boucher's acknowledgement came as critics charged that the Bush administration attempted to use the State Department to unearth information that might embarrass Bill Clinton. Boucher said there were no contacts between the Bush campaign and the State Department on the Clinton files. Boucher also said that Consular Affairs Officer Elizabeth Tamposi, a former Republican Party fundraiser, did not attempt to expedite the process. Tamposi made calls about the request to the U.S. Embassy in London and elsewhere, but Boucher said those calls were designed to ensure the requests were properly handled. The major presidential candidates have arrived in Richmond, Virginia, to prepare for tonight's nationally broadcast debate. The confrontation will be conducted under a new format, a single moderator directing questions from the audience. Members of the audience were selected by the Gallup organization, and they're supposed to represent uncommitted voters. The debate moderator, ABC's Carol Simpson, will choose the individual questioners from an audience of about 250. A dispute between the Presidential Debate Commission and Michigan State University, the site of next Monday's final debate, has been settled. School officials had threatened to cancel the event, saying students weren't given enough tickets. Don Gagne reports.
Monday's debate will take place in Michigan State University's Wharton Center, but of the 900 or so available seats, only 25 were initially set aside for students. That wasn't enough for interim university president Gordon Guyer, who said he wanted 300 student tickets. Yesterday, Guyer said he'd call the whole thing off if something couldn't be worked out. Today, the debate commission promised to come up with the tickets the school has requested. University spokesman Terry Denbaugh.
To have that debate in the heart of our campus without at least 300 students would be counter to our traditions, our philosophy, and even hypocritical to how we as a university have promoted this event as an educational opportunity for all.
More than 4,000 students have signed up for a lottery through which the debate tickets will be distributed. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 21 points to close at 3,174.68. Advances edge declines. This is NPR. Luanda, the capital of Angola, was said to be relatively calm this evening after a massive explosion last night at an ammunition dump. The city's been tense with the prospect of a renewed civil war over alleged vote fraud in the parliamentary elections. Opposition leader Jonas Savimbi said today that the latest election results showed President José Eduardo dos Santos with less than 50% of the votes. Savimbi said a runoff election will be held. Savimbi's UNITA group denied involvement in last night's ammunition dump explosion. In Egypt, hundreds of angry victims of Monday's earthquake stormed a government building in Giza province today, protesting a lack of aid. From Cairo, Lori Neff reports the demonstration comes as the official death toll from the earthquake rose to more than 500.
The demonstrators complained they'd yet to receive any aid or housing. They said 23 of their villagers died and scores of their homes collapsed in the earthquake. Officials calmed them down with promises of assistance. The death toll increased as rescue teams continued digging through rubble from hundreds of buildings that collapsed in the quake. Some 40 of the victims recovered today were dug out of the wreckage of a 14-story building in the Cairo suburb of Heliopolis. Aftershocks continue to shake the country. Seismologists say the tremors could continue for another 2 to 4 weeks. Authorities estimate rebuilding will cost some $140 million. So far, Arab and Western countries have pledged some $350 million in aid. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
Shareholders groups are applauding new federal rules intended to make corporations more accountable to their stockholders. The Securities and Exchange Commission adopted new regulations today that are designed to force companies to spell out how much their top executives are paid. The commission also approved new proxy rules that would make it easier for stockholders to communicate among themselves and to challenge management over corporate policies. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 30 years ago today, the CIA learned that the Soviet Union had secretly moved nuclear missiles into Cuba. So began perhaps the most frightening crisis of the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy and his aides first considered the possibility of airstrikes on the missile sites, but decided instead to begin a naval blockade of Cuba. We knew America and the Soviet Union came close to nuclear war that October, but we didn't realize how close until very recently. The secret documents from the crisis, including letters by Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro, were recently made public. This is largely the result of a 6-year-long Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by the National Security Archive. My guest, Tom Blanton, directs the archive. The declassified documents are now available to the public, collected in the new book, The Cuban Missile Crisis. I asked Blanton how close we did come to nuclear war.
The new documents on the Cuban Missile Crisis show that we were much, much closer to a nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States than even the decision makers at the time thought. And the key to this has been the revelations from the Soviet side that they had tactical nuclear warheads in Cuba, and that if the United States had invaded Cuba to take out the missile sites for the larger ballistic missiles, the local Soviet commanders would have used those tactical nukes. And as Robert McNamara, Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, said, what would have been the result? Well, the Americans would have responded in kind, and the end would have been utter disaster.
When you say the local Soviet commanders had...
Cuba.
So it wasn't even Khrushchev's call, it was just local commanders'
exactly.
call.
Exactly. And I think that is the real point of what all these new documents have come to, and what all the former officials on both sides have now realized, which is one of the reasons that it got so dangerous was because it was, in a sense, out of control. From the United States side, we interpreted everything that happened in Cuba as a direct line to the Kremlin. We had a very exaggerated notion of the centralized control on their side, so that if they shot down a reconnaissance plane, which they did at the height of the crisis in Washington, President Kennedy and his advisors thought that must have been ordered by the Kremlin. And from the Kremlin side, they thought that everything we did was ordered by Washington. So when the Strategic Air Command went on its second highest level of alert, I mean, the highest level is war, the Strategic Air Command general did it in an open channel. And the Soviets thought, oh, Kennedy must have ordered that. They're about to go to war. This is a classic case of why crisis management is such a myth, that we now find out things were spiraling out of control. And if there's one underlying psychological dynamic that brought the settlement about, I think it was the realization by both Khrushchev and Kennedy that they didn't have so much control as they had thought.
So had we invaded Cuba, we probably would have been under nuclear attack. How close did we come to invading Cuba? Is there new information about that in the recently declassified documents?
Well, there's a conflict between among the president's advisors in their ex post facto reconstruction of the crisis. Secretary McNamara and the National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy both say that President Kennedy would have cut a deal and stopped short of an invasion. But if you look at the military plans, the CIA plans, all the things that were really underway, and put yourself in the shoes of the Cubans or the Soviets, they foresaw an invasion coming long before the missiles actually got to Cuba. It's one of the reasons they put them there. And they were in a position where they had a lot of incentives to do some preemptive action. So we came very close in the sense that neither side was in control anymore, in the sense of centralized control, and that there were tactical newts on the ground. But I think that Bundy may have a point that both Khrushchev and Kennedy were very scared of any such final military action. But for the first few days of the crisis, a military invasion was what was the first item on pretty much most of the American advisors' list, including Bobby Kennedy's.
Who are the people in the administration that argued most forcefully for invading Cuba to get rid of the Soviet missiles?
Well, there's this wonderful story about how the Kennedy administration brought in some of the old wise men to advise them in this hour of crisis. One of those was Dean Acheson, who had been Secretary of State under Harry Truman and one of the architects of the whole containment policy against the Soviet Union. Supposedly, Acheson said at one of these high-level meetings of what was known as the XCOM, the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, just the closest top advisors, Acheson said, "Well, of course we got to take them out." And somebody asked him, "Well, Mr. Acheson, how would the Soviets respond to that?" And Acheson said, "Well, I suppose they'd have to take out our missiles in Turkey." And then the person said, "Well, what will we have to do in response to that?" He said, "Oh, well, to support our NATO alliance and back up our ally Turkey, we'd probably have to attack some of the Soviet missiles maybe in the Soviet Union." And the person said, "Well, what happens then?" And Acheson said, "Well, hopefully by then cooler heads would prevail." Which sort of made the bigger point that we all needed the cooler heads to prevail from the start as opposed to at the finish.
Is there a new understanding as a result of these documents of the Soviet motives for bringing missiles into Cuba in the first place?
I think that's those are some of the most extraordinary revelations, because as a result of a six-year-long Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, we at the National Security Archive finally forced the State Department in January of this year to release Khrushchev's own letters to Kennedy and Kennedy's responses. A few of those had been released previously, but the government was still withholding these on the grounds that it was sensitive foreign government information. A key advisor to our whole project, a professor at American University, Phil Brenner, had the idea of just going to the new Russian government and getting a little diplomatic note from them saying, "Hey, we wouldn't mind if those letters came out." And between that note and our lawsuit, State Department finally released. And now we have these extraordinary missives, some of them obviously personally written or dictated by Khrushchev, just because of the emotional content and the very personalized appeals that he makes. There's one really extraordinary one on October 26 to President Kennedy that has a really amazing plea from Khrushchev that puts very strongly the Soviet claim that they weren't taking the offensive by putting these missiles in Cuba. From their point of view, these missiles were defensive. They were simply a match for the fact that the U.S. had missiles in Turkey. Supposedly at one point Khrushchev was walking around in his garden at his dacha on the Black Sea and with some foreigner and pointed across the Black Sea to Turkey and said, "There are U.S. missiles over there right now pointing right at us, right at this garden." So in a sense, one of their motives had to be giving the Americans a little taste of their own psychological medicine. But here's Khrushchev's words to Kennedy, and I think it's a remarkable statement, and you can read this fellow's personality, and I think that's the most amazing thing about these new releases. Here's what he said. This is in the middle of this letter on October 26. He said, "But Mr. President, do you really seriously think that Cuba could launch an offensive upon the United States and that even we, together with Cuba, could advance against you from Cuban territory? Do you really think so? How can that be? We do not understand. Surely there has not been any such new development military strategy that would lead one to believe that it is possible to advance that way. And I mean advance, not destroy. For those who destroy are barbarians, people who have lost their sanity. We are sane people. We do understand and assess the situation correctly. How could we then allow the wrong actions which you ascribe to us? Only lunatics or suicides. who themselves want to perish and before they die destroy the world, could do this. But we want to live, and by no means do we want to destroy your country. We want something quite different, to compete with your country in a peaceful endeavor.
How much do you trust those sentiments?
Clearly they're self-serving, because Khrushchev is attempting to persuade Kennedy not to back off of these harsh actions. Kennedy had announced a quarantine. He had accused the Soviet Union of outright deception, of lying directly to him. And in fact, Kennedy was correct. The Soviets had lied directly to the U.S. about the placement of these missiles in Cuba. And I think in a strange way, as Castro said at the January conference in Havana this year, Castro said he had urged Khrushchev to put the missiles there not in secrecy, because if he did it openly, the U.S. would be faced with an open international parallel. You've got missiles in Turkey, we're going to put missiles in Cuba. But to do it in secret opened yourself up to exactly the accusation that Kennedy made, the bad faith. It was a major, if you will, a psychological blow for Kennedy to be able to make that accusation and have it stick.
But you think that these documents do reveal that the rationale for putting the missiles in Cuba was to protect Cuba from invasion. It was a defensive, not offensive rationale.
Oh, I think defensive is there's a complex answer to that. The simple answer that the Americans had always maintained was that Khrushchev had put these missiles in Cuba as a unilateral, aggressive action to tilt the balance in the world strategic nuclear force balance. And from what we now know with these released documents, these transcripts inside the executive, the XCOM, it's clear that Robert McNamara and others didn't even believe that at the time. McNamara is quoted in one of these transcripts as saying, it doesn't really change the balance. Kennedy is saying, President Kennedy personally says, yeah, it doesn't matter if the missile comes from the Soviet Union or comes from Cuba. It does the same damage. The world would have Holocaust no matter what. So they both agreed it was primarily a political problem, a domestic political problem. But ever since, the myth has been, and the American position has been, that this was a unilateral aggressive action. But if you put yourself in the Soviet shoes, you see them trying to accomplish two defensive purposes, if you will. One of them, to put these missiles in Cuba, is kind of a doomsday device. They knew that Cuba could never withstand a full U.S. military invasion. Just the U.S. had too many forces and Cuba too few. And so by putting the missiles there, that would create a kind of a tripwire that would be a disincentive for the U.S. to invade. Second defensive purpose was to kind of match up with the missiles in Turkey and create a little bit of a balance and, if you will, equalize what the Russians well knew were highly unequal forces. The U.S. had, I think, 4, 5, 6, 7 times as many nuclear missiles and warheads as the Soviets did at that point. So the defensiveness and offensiveness becomes a semantic question. And in Khrushchev's objections all along, he keeps saying, these are defensive. But Khrushchev lost that argument at the time, because he had done it in secret, so it looked like they were offensive. Now I think we understand the motivations, and they were much more complex.
Did you feel like you learned anything new about how frightened people in the Kennedy administration were about the possibility of nuclear war?
Very much so. There's an extraordinary quote from, for instance, Dean Rusk, who was the Secretary of State at the time when the U.S. had set up the quarantine line to keep the Soviet ships from steaming to Cuba with more missiles and supplies. Kennedy announced the quarantine. The Navy went out there. A bunch of Soviet freighters were on their way. And then the first ones stopped dead in the water. And Rusk is said to have said, "We were eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other fellow just blinked." There was this sense of crisis. McNamara said one of the mornings of the crisis, the morning of October 28th, after the U-2 pilot had been shot down over Cuba, and the Americans interpreted that as an order from the Kremlin to escalate this thing. When McNamara woke up, he said he looked around and he was amazed because he was still alive.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Blanton, and he's the head of the National Security Archive, which gets classified documents made public through Freedom of Information Act lawsuits, and that's how they got documents from the Cuban Missile Crisis, and those documents are included in a new book called The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis with Tom Blanton, the head of the National Security Archive. How do these newly released documents revise our understanding of how the missile crisis was ended?
Publicly, the story that we heard was Khrushchev backed down, he's pulling the missiles out, and Kennedy is saying, look, we've got no intention to invade Cuba as long as we can verify that there aren't these missiles there. What we now know from the documents and the interviews that these documents have generated with former officials is that Bobby Kennedy carried a secret message to the Soviets saying, look, really, we're willing to take the Jupiter missiles out of Turkey that you're so worried about, but we can't do it publicly because it undermines a NATO ally. But we can assure you that early next year, we'll go ahead and take them out because they're obsolete anyway. And so there was a classic secret diplomatic negotiation that the American public was never told about, but that was the underlying factor in Khrushchev, I think, being willing to accept a deal, back down, and lose face. Afterwards, Khrushchev wrote a long letter to Castro, which is a fascinating postmortem on just what Khrushchev thought had occurred. Castro felt sold out by Khrushchev because Khrushchev had backed down.
Well, also, didn't Khrushchev not bother to consult Castro before reaching this agreement?
Exactly. And Castro at one point sent a very hot-headed letter to Khrushchev when Castro thought the U.S. was about to invade in the middle of the crisis. And the text of the letter sounds almost like Castro is saying, use them or lose them.
Well, actually, let me quote from that. Castro wrote, if they actually carry out the brutal act of invading Cuba in violation of all international law and morality, that would be the moment to eliminate such danger forever through an act of clear, legitimate defense, however harsh and terrible the solution would be.
That's right. And there you see some of the problem about using the word defensive weapons, because Castro is saying if U.S. invades, that is with conventional weapons, use the nuclear weapons, which would clearly be a major escalation. And yet, it's a good thing that the invasion didn't happen. It's a very good thing that those tactical nukes weren't used. And it's a very good thing the nuclear exchange didn't happen. But it wasn't skill in crisis management, and it wasn't brinksmanship eyeball to eyeball. It was luck in many respects and a secret diplomatic deal.
But isn't the secret diplomatic deal part of the brinksmanship and skill?
No, because I think the lesson of brinksmanship is you can play chicken with the other guys. And in fact, we didn't play chicken with the other guys. In fact, we offered them a secret deal under the table and didn't tell the public about it so they could go back to their hardliners and say, look, we achieved something. In public, it looked like we were playing chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of scholars and policymakers ever since have said the lesson of the missile crisis is be tough and be strong. And if you draw that kind of lesson, then what you need to do with your military policy is talk tough, have a lot more guns than the other guy, and go eyeball to eyeball with him, and he'll blink. In fact, that's not the real story of the missile crisis. The real story is find out a deal that the other guy would accept that would help him save face and give him some of what he wants and get out of the crisis through a diplomatic negotiation, not brinksmanship.
Why was Khrushchev willing to look like he was backing down?
Very good question. I think he had set out with, I think, two goals in putting the missiles in Cuba. One goal was to forestall an invasion of Cuba by the U.S., which looked like it was going to happen. And the second was to match up with the U.S. missiles that were in Europe and Turkey very close to his borders and, if you will, sort of neutralize that, at least psychologically. And when Kennedy agreed to say publicly that the U.S. wouldn't invade Cuba and that the public deal was, we'll say we won't invade, you pull out the missiles, and the secret deal is we'll also take our missiles out of Turkey, I think Khrushchev at that point felt, first and foremost, if he didn't back down, the crisis was almost out of control. And second, that he had a deal through the secret deal that he could save face internally within his own military and national security advisors. So that was enough.
Something else that emerges from these recently released formerly classified documents is that Kennedy didn't want a settlement that would compromise the United States' efforts to overthrow Castro.
That's the most remarkable, I think, of the brand new documents just released this year under this Freedom of Information lawsuit that we brought against State Department. And that is Kennedy's letters right at the time that Khrushchev backed down seemed to make an almost explicit pledge that the United States would no longer consider an invasion of Cuba. And what we see after October 28th, when Khrushchev backed down, is a watering down of that pledge, and now we have a lot of the internal documents about why. And we have some of these State Department documents and studies that say, look, let's put real strong conditions on any no-invasion pledge. Let's say we'll only pledge if we can get UN verification that there are no more missiles there. Well, of course, I think they knew that the Cubans would never allow such a thing. What a violation of national sovereignty, etc. So they put conditions on that they thought wouldn't be fulfilled, and that way, and some of these documents say explicitly, that way we keep the option open for doing whatever we need to do in the future about Castro. And ultimately, by November 20th, and that's one of the other pieces of news out of these documents, that the crisis wasn't just 13 days. They called it 13 days because that allowed it to end right before the midterm congressional elections that year, and the Kennedys were nothing if they weren't political and very politically astute. So they declared the crisis over. In fact, though, tensions continued on well into November over the remaining Soviet bombers and other nuclear-capable items in Cuba, and it wasn't until November 20th that the crisis really ended. And the crisis ended without any firm, unconditioned pledge from the U.S. In essence, Khrushchev backed off. He got a highly conditioned pledge, which said verification and these other, and Cuba can't take aggressive action in the hemisphere. So Khrushchev didn't get nearly what he thought he was getting. The U.S. kept its options open to continue to go after Castro, which they did. But the Jupiters did ultimately come out of Turkey.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archive. The recently declassified documents are collected in the new book, The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962, published by the New Press. On the second part of our show, we'll talk more about the Cuban Missile Crisis, as well as the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that declassified the secret documents. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the Kennedy-Khrushchev letters. 30 years ago, when we were on the brink of nuclear war, Khrushchev and Kennedy were communicating slowly through letters. We'll continue our conversation with Tom Blanton of the National Security Archive. His group filed the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that released the secret documents from the Cuban Missile Crisis. Blanton will also tell us about his ongoing investigation into the Iran-Contra affair. And speaking of newly uncovered documents, the public is about to have access for the first time to the pilot of Gilligan's Island. TV critic David Bianculli has a preview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Bush, Bill Clinton, and Ross Perot face off an hour and a half from now in the second presidential debate. While Bill Clinton hopes to strengthen his lead, President Bush hopes to reverse his standing, and Ross Perot wants to re-energize his followers. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Richmond.
Tonight's debate may be more exciting than the first. It follows the vice presidential matchup, which was considerably more aggressive in tone. While President Bush needs to do something dramatic to reverse his fortune, it is unlikely that a single debate will provide that opportunity. His advisors are counseling him to pick and choose his battles, but to remain presidential. Governor Clinton is expected to repeat his first night's performance. His aim is to keep the focus on the economy and Mr. Bush's record of the last 4 years. The wild card, once again, is Ross Perot, but the question is whether Mr. Bush or Mr. Clinton will more aggressively take him on. Tonight's format could also shake things up. Questions will be taken from an audience of undecided voters. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Richmond.
The Bush campaign rejects Democratic charges that the president has not been honest about what he knows about the Iran-Contra scandal and U.S. relations with Iraq before the Gulf War. Democratic vice presidential candidate Al Gore said today, Mr. Bush is behind a cover-up much bigger than Watergate. Gore called on President Bush to release transcripts of his testimony to Iran-Contra investigators and documents of his dealings with Iraq before the Gulf War. Vice President Dan Quayle called the accusations nonsense. Members of Congress will get a 3.2% pay raise next year under the provisions of a law passed 3 years ago. Federal judges and top executive branch officials will receive the same increase. The director of payroll in the House says salaries for representatives and senators will go from $129,000 a year to $133,000. American Airlines, the nation's largest air carrier, has announced massive layoffs. Bill Zeeble of member station KERA in Dallas has more.
Americans said between 500 and 1,000 managers will be gone by next year, saving 10% of the management payroll. That amounts to $300 million, if not more, according to the airline. For more than half a year, Americans have been taking heavy losses. Last July, they announced a $166 million loss for the second quarter. Today's announcement anticipates a heavy third quarter loss. Results are due later this month. The airline's simplified four-tier pricing system, trumpeted last April, remains intact despite today's announcement. Basic prices, however, increased in September, and more are slated for late October. American's chairman Robert Crandall says the layoffs and losses reflect the dismal financial condition of the entire industry. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Stock prices closed mixed on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing 20.80 to close at 3174.68. This is NPR News. The federal government today issued new rules giving shareholders a bigger voice in how the companies they invest in are run. The Securities and Exchange Commission approved new guidelines forcing companies to show how much top executives are paid. The rules also make it easier for shareholders to challenge company management and the makeup of corporate boards. The move comes as shareholders question the multi-million dollar pay packages of top officers. They complain executive pay often continues to rise, even as their companies lose money and lay off lower-level workers. A jury in New York City has convicted a subway driver on manslaughter charges in what prosecutors called the worst subway crash in the city's history. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports.
39-year-old Robert Ray displayed no emotion as the jury foreman read the verdict, guilty of 5 counts of manslaughter for the August 1991 crash in which 5 people died and more than 200 were injured. Ray was also convicted of 15 counts of assault, but he was acquitted of the most serious charges of second-degree murder. A murder conviction required proof that Ray showed depraved indifference by being drunk before he took the controls. Ray was not found until hours after the incident, when a blood alcohol test showed 2 to 3 times the legal limit. Defense attorneys insisted Ray did most of his drinking after the crash. The prosecutor noted that Ray offered no help to panicked passengers, saying the ship's captain was the first one to get in the lifeboat and get out. Ray faces a maximum of 5 to 15 years in prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchcliffe in New York.
Standard & Poor's agency says it may reduce General Motors' debt rating next year if GM fails to turn around its struggling car business. A lower S&P rating would mean higher interest rates for GM in the corporate bond market. It's also a loss in prestige, as the company would be viewed as a more risky investment. GM plans to cut 74,000 jobs and close 21 plants over the next few years. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Blanton for part two of our interview. Blanton directs the National Security Archive, which filed the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that won the release of secret documents about the Cuban Missile Crisis. The crisis began 30 years ago today, when America discovered Soviet missiles in Cuba. The declassified documents are collected in the new book, The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962. Now, this new book on the Cuban Missile Crisis includes letters between Kennedy and Khrushchev, between Khrushchev and Castro. And I just found myself amazed as I was reading these letters to think that in the middle of this crisis that could have easily led to nuclear war, that Kennedy and Khrushchev were writing letters to each other. I mean, and what, mailing them airmail?
Well, some of them came through teletype. Some of them came by cable. But one of the... That's one of the most fun stories. I think the Soviet ambassador, Dobrynin, at one point said that it was the most remarkable sort of Stone Age communication, because they would get their cable in code, translate it from code into Russian or English, call a messenger who would ride up on a bicycle to the Soviet embassy, give it to the messenger, the bicyclist would, you know, head down 16th Street to the White House, deliver the letter. That's this whole little episode and some of the 8-hour delays in getting letters through led to two things. One, when Khrushchev made his proposal to withdraw the missiles, he did it over the radio so there wouldn't be any delay. And second, they installed what became known as the hotline.
Oh, I see. The hotline wasn't installed till accidents.
Exactly. How dangerous to have an 8-hour lapse at a time in which you got anti-aircraft batteries shooting down planes and invasion forces massing and ships coming head-to-head in the Caribbean, and just what a notion that you could have these letters being slowly teletyped out and handed by bicycle messengers.
Absolutely.
To each side.
I know, and then you know, the hotline became such an important part of Cold War iconography.
Exactly.
In the 60s.
But it was a very smart thing. I mean, that way you could have that kind of direct communication.
Wait, no, my image is of like Kennedy or Khrushchev thinking like, you know, what's the right adjective to use here? Because you know? They are very kind of gracefully written letters that they send back and forth.
It's true. Kennedy's are much more a group product. You can see the fine hand of Ted Sorensen, a superb speechwriter and counsel to the president, in some of the phrases and some of the carefully couched assurances that Kennedy makes. Khrushchev's letters, you can tell the ones that are the group product, the result of the Politburo and a little bit more hard line, and you can tell the ones that seem to almost been dictated off the top of his head by him. They're just overflowing with this passionate, almost emotional approach to the whole crisis.
Let me ask you how you decided to sue through the Freedom of Information Act to declassify the Cuban Missile Crisis documents.
Well, at the National Security Archive, our specialty, our niche in life, is trying to use the Freedom of Information Act to get out the hidden history of national security policymaking. This is the area that of the U.S. government that's probably surrounded with the most mystery. It's the area where policymakers and president after president has done this, Democrat or Republican. They say to the American people, trust me on this one. I've got access to the secrets. I can't tell you about them. I can't tell you why, but I'm going to make these decisions. What we believe fundamentally that the American people need to know this history. They need to know what were the underpinnings of the decision. They need to understand the debates on all sides. They need to get the process demystified so that they themselves can understand and participate and be better citizens. We have to know our own history to draw the lessons that will help guide us. And so we filed FOIA requests, FOIA, Freedom of Information requests, for some of this material. And many journalists and scholars had tried to do it. But back in 1986 and 87, we started interviewing some of the former officials, come to find out that the government itself had created a little mini-archive of these documents hidden away in an office in the State Department that doesn't ordinarily get searched when a Freedom of Information request comes in. But we got a good description of what was there and then filed a series of systematic FOIA requests. We didn't get any responses, so that meant we had to go to court. We had pro bono legal help from the law firm Kroll & Mooring, which took this case at no charge to us because of the historical importance of this whole case. Learning the lessons of this crisis, here we are 30 years later, and there's still myths about brinksmanship and about going eyeball to eyeball, and there's still myths about how the crisis was resolved, and there's still misunderstanding about Soviet and Cuban motives, and we still are learning the truth of our own history.
Do you question the government's motives for keeping these documents classified for so long?
I do question their motives in the sense that I think it was bureaucratic inertia, certainly, that keeps this stuff classified for 30 years, but it's also the precedent that is set. We argued that they should release this stuff because no other event of the Cold War shaped our whole nuclear policy and our interpretation of Soviet intentions more than the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, that really fed, I would argue, a lot of the Vietnam syndrome, the sense that you had to be tough with the Russians and they would back down. You had to go eyeball to eyeball, and I think that's sort of what we tried to do in Vietnam, and it was a failure. So I think we see the government's motivations in this as protecting their own ability to make the decisions without criticism and without input from outside. There's a bureaucratic tendency to sort of cover your rear and not have your mistakes exposed to the public. And the other excuse they gave was if they released this, they'd be violating the communications with a foreign government. Well, so it really helped when the Russian government said, hey, we should release this. We're in a very strange situation now with the end of the Cold War where there is greater access to the KGB files, for instance, in Moscow than there is to CIA files here in Langley, Virginia. It's a very strange situation because by no means is the KGB access systematic. They're pulling things out piece by piece for political purposes to embarrass Gorbachev or whatever. But you have this remarkable sea change in the whole rationale for keeping all this kind of stuff secret, and the U.S. government hadn't faced up to it yet.
My guest Tom Blanton directs the National Security Archive, which filed the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that declassified secret documents from the Cuban Missile Crisis. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Blanton. He heads the National Security Archive. After a six-year-long suit, it had released formerly classified documents about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and those documents are in the new book, The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962. I want to change the subject to another Freedom of Information Act suit that you have underway, and that's to get papers relating to the Iran-Contra affair. Since you've been investigating the Iran-Contra affair, I'm wondering if there are questions you think should be raised by journalists at the debates, perhaps, about Iran-Contra.
Well, I think the key issues remaining in Iran-Contra that relate to President Bush just go to the issue of responsibility and being in the loop or being out of the loop. He has said pretty much from the beginning of when the scandal was announced in November of 86, he's tried to say that he was out of the loop because he faced a very tough choice, I think. He could either say, gee, I was in all these meetings, but I didn't get it, meaning a very experienced foreign policy analyst who had been former CIA director and twice an ambassador and who had as much foreign policy experience as anyone in the Reagan cabinet, didn't get what was going on despite all the briefings. Or he could say, well, gee, I was out of the loop. So it was either incompetence or out of the loop. Those were his two choices, and he chose out of the loop. The problem is that over the last 6 years, every year has brought a new set of documents declassified, a new set of releases, a new set of evidence that puts Bush very much in the loop inside small groups of men making the decisions. The day that Ronald Reagan signed the presidential order that authorized direct arms for hostage trades with Iran, there were only four other people in the room with President Reagan, and one of them was George Bush. Or at the end of the scandal, the day that President Reagan signed that Bible, autographed that Bible to send off to the Iranians as a sign of good faith, there were only four other people in the room, and one of them was George Bush. It becomes very difficult for Bush to maintain this out-of-the-loop, I didn't understand position when the documentary evidence puts him inside the very small group of people who were pushing the project forward, who were certainly approving it.
Do you think that Bush has been lying about Iran-Contra?
I think there was a extraordinary phrase that the CIA official in charge of the Contra program used when he described what he had done in his testimony to Congress. He said he had been technically correct and specifically evasive. In Bush's case, he used the phrase out of the loop in a very specific way. And he said so to Dan Rather. He said, here's what I mean by being out of the loop, Dan. I mean, no operational role. Well, no one ever expects the vice president to have an operational role. When the American people hear the phrase out of the loop, we think, he didn't know. He wasn't there. He was out of the loop. That's what we understand out of the loop to mean. I think Bush means something different by saying out of the loop. He means, look, maybe I was briefed, maybe I knew, maybe I got these documents, I've got CCs on the bottom here, I was in these meetings, but I wasn't operational. I wasn't making the choices. He really played, I think, much more of a kind of passive role. I think I said this before when we've talked about Iran-Contra. He was kind of on the receiving end of these briefings and these catalogs of deals. It was like the Book of the Month Club. He got the briefing. He never said no. He never sent back the postcard, and so the deals kept coming. But there's not this top-down George Bush ordering Ollie North to go do something. And I think that is why Bush and the various official investigators have not been able to pin down Bush's, quote, operational role.
Tom, one last question. How many Freedom of Information Act lawsuits do you have in the air right now?
We've got about a dozen. We have a Freedom of Information case for the remainder of Oliver North's notebooks. We have this Cuban Missile Crisis Freedom of Information case that's resulted in the documents that are in this documents reader that's published this week. We have a case where we're trying to make sure the White House saves the computer tapes for its electronic mail system from the Reagan years. They tried to destroy them. We've got a lawsuit to save them and put them in the archives so that the American people will keep their own history, if you will. We've got cases against the FBI to look at how they attempted to recruit librarians as informants on Americans. We have a case to uncover the hidden history of the American attempt to rescue the hostages that were held by the Iranians in Tehran in 1979, 1980, and 81. So there are a series of those. What we're really about is we're trying to use the Freedom of Information Act to get out this the underlying documents, the hidden history, to put the public in the loop about how these choices were made, and then to get them out in a way that demystifies the process, lets us all in on the secrets, and empowers us all as active citizens.
You ever worried about violating necessary secrecy?
I think that most everybody who's ever been inside the system and had those top secret clearances and had access to classified data, they'll all tell you that way too much stuff is classified. And I think just on the economics of the thing, the government's going to have to cut back on the number of secrets that it makes because it costs them so much money to do all the clearance investigations, buy all the safes, maintain all the systems for controlling the documents. There is a core group of materials that most people would agree should be protected. Like, you shouldn't reveal the specifications for a chemical binary warhead, for instance, because if Gaddafi got a hold of those, he might be able to build a better bomb. Technical aspects of weapon systems. Maybe even, you know, you want to protect your ability to gather intelligence abroad, because if you gave out all that information, the people on the other end would be able to, Saddam Hussein would have been able to hide his own nuclear and chemical buildup better than he did, and so forth. So there are clear secrets that should be kept, but most secrets could be released very quickly, very shortly after they're made. And I think the government has got itself in a trap where it's choking on these secrets. They're creating 7 million new secrets every year. We at the National Security Archive, we're a little nonprofit group. We get released about 20,000 a year from our Freedom of Information request. So you can see the trend lines are in the wrong direction. 7 million are created. We get about 20,000 out. Other people get another 20, 30,000. So if it keeps going this way, we're going to build up a backlog of secrets that we're never going to be able to process. And meanwhile, the American people are robbed of their history and robbed of the ability to understand where we are and how we got here.
Well, Tom Blanton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Blanton directs the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. The recently declassified Cuban Missile Crisis documents are collected in the new book, The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962, published by the New Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what will you be doing to preview tonight's presidential debate?
Mara Liasson and Elizabeth Arnold will be talking with us about what's coming up, what we can expect from the event in Richmond. Also, I have the last of a three-part series on Russia and Alaska. This story tonight is about a trip we took across the Bering Strait over to the Russian Far East to the town of Providenia, about 4,000 people in that town. We'll be talking about cultural issues and joint business ventures. And John McLean, the son of Norman McLean, who wrote the book A River Runs Through It, will be talking with us about the film made from that book and about the book itself and about his father.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Hardcore fans of the TV series Star Trek are well aware that there were two pilots to that show, one with the familiar characters and actors, which became the episode first televised, and an earlier version that only the network executives saw. Until decades later, that is, when continued interest in the series resulted in the broadcast of the original pilot. Friday night, cable superstation TBS presents the TV premiere of another formerly unseen original pilot from the 60s, and TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailor and the skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a three-hour tour.
Yep, just when you thought it was safe to go back to the television set. Think of what this means. Back in 1964, TV producer Sherwood Schwartz went into the offices of CBS and pitched an idea for a sitcom about seven people stranded on a desert island. He may have called it a microcosm, or he may have been honest and called it macro stupid. But whatever he did, CBS bought the idea, but wasn't crazy about the pilot Schwartz delivered. So they asked him to make a few changes and try again. He did, and CBS approved, and you know the rest. Gilligan's Island lasted for only 3 years, but it's haunted us ever since, and has led to such bottom-of-the-barrel landmarks as the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island, the worst telemovie this side of A Very Brady Christmas, which was another Sherwood Schwartz production, but that's another story. This story has to do with the unexpected unearthing of the original Gilligan's Island pilot, which can be looked at in one of two ways. One way is to treat it as a landmark of marginal social significance, and enjoy it like a literary scholar might enjoy reading the rough draft of a short story. The other way is to realize that this pilot is actually worse than the Gilligan's Island we've come to know, but probably not love. As Count Floyd might say, "Ooh, that's scary, boys and girls." And it is scary. Even the theme song is worse. It tries to be Calypso by way of Mexico.
In tropical sea is a tropic port. Vacation fun is the favorite sport. This is the place where the tourists flock, renting the boats at the busy dock.
What else is different here? Well, the cruise is 6 hours, not three. And the cast and characters aren't all the same. The majority of them survived intact. Bob Denver as Gilligan, Alan Hale Jr. as the skipper, and Jim Backus and Natalie Schaefer as Mr. and Mrs. Howell. But instead of Russell Johnson as the professor, we have John Gabriel. And instead of Tina Louise as movie star Ginger and Don Wells as farm girl Mary Ann, we have Nancy McCarthy and Kit Smythe as secretaries, a plain brunette named Ginger, and a sexy dumb blonde named Bunny. As for the level of humor and sensitivity in the original Gilligan's Island pilot, well, let's just say it meets the standards of the series itself.
Now hear this, folks. We've all got enough to keep us busy. The professor here, he's fixing the transmitter. Gilligan is out there right now fishing for our dinner. And you girls wash all the dirty clothes on board.
Aye, aye, Skipper.
When, or make that if, we look at this unexpected TV artifact, we ought to at least take comfort in the fact that in this case, they don't make them like they used to. Except they still do. Has anybody out there seen Whoops, the new sitcom from Fox? It's about the last survivors of a nuclear accident. And there are six of them, see, including a school teacher, a greedy rich guy, an extremely sexy young woman, and where do these TV producers get their ideas?
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with AIDS activist Martin Delaney about smuggling in AIDS drugs that haven't been approved in America and his efforts to reform how new AIDS drugs are tested in this country. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.